A lonely alien pet bravely waits for the family that may never return. An astronaut with seconds to live discovers just how good victory can taste. A mecha pilot and an aristocrat strike up an unlikely friendship. Take a ride with Escape Pod, the Hugo-nominated weekly science fiction podcast at escapepod.org. Every week, we'll launch you into an alternate reality. So buckle up, it's story time.
This is Slice of Sci-Fi, episode 950. Dude. Hello and hi. Welcome to a very special Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and with me this evening is a cast of characters who are chomping at the bit to have their say about Star Wars, because as one of our guests, Django Wexler, said a few weeks ago, nitpicking is love. And after my interview with Django on Writers After Dark, I said, you know, I know a lot of fans who do Star Wars. I think I can pull something together to let this man get this stuff off his chest. So here we are. Django, tell everyone hello.
Hi, I'm Django Wexler. I'm a fantasy author. My latest book out is called Ashes of the Sun, which is actually, you know, kind of inspired by Star Wars, which is what we talked about on the interview and kind of led to this thing. And then I'm also, my first little piece of writing for Star Wars, which I'm super excited about, is going to be in the Certain Point of View Empire Strikes Back anthology, which comes out in October, November. So that's me. That's what I'm up to.
And Seth, tell everyone who you are and what you've been up to.
Hey guys, I'm Seth Dickinson. I write novels. My last book, The Tyrant, Barrow Cormorant, came out a couple days ago. I also have a story in the Star Wars anthology coming up. And I think, I'm not sure I'm the youngest one here, but I grew up in the 90s when kind of the Star Wars EU was taking off. So that was a big part of my childhood. I also write for video games like Destiny.
And next we have Max.
Hi, I'm Max Gladstone. As of 2 weeks ago, Hugo Award-winning author of co-author of Empress of Forever with Mal Matar, and also won the Nebula and a bunch of other stuff. Really cool book. It's been a fun year.
The Time War.
Wrong book, Max.
Oh God, damn! Didn't I say that? Yeah.
You've written so many.
I got all my wires crossed.
They are.
In my defense, I'm full-time parenting at this juncture of our year of pandemic, so everything's a little bit coming apart at the seams. So yes, This Is How You Lose the Time War is the book that I was just talking about. My most Star Wars-y related project was probably Empress of Forever, which also came out last year and is big galaxy-hopping space opera and a lot of fun. And yeah, that's it for me outside of my general confusion with proper nouns and the titles of my own work.
And next up we have Christina.
Hi, I'm Christina Henry, and I am a horror and dark fantasy author. So I've written no space operas and no Star Wars stories. So at first glance, I do not belong here. But I have a podcast that I do with my friends where we review movies and sometimes TV shows. And we discussed The Mandalorian excessively. So, Summer, let me come and join your gang for the night.
And last up, we have my good dear friend, Nerd Soul.
Hey guys, that's right, Nerd Soul, Michael. You can find me on YouTube. What I do is basically cover the nexus of hip hop and geek. This week we've gone into Nas's new album, also Lovecraft Country, which has been crazy. We'll be covering Death Metal Zombie Cop because I've read it for like the third time, and Felipe Smith is amazing. So that's what you can get there.
Awesome. And like Django said earlier, we are here to nitpick Star Wars because we love this universe. And there are a number of people, places, happenings that irritate us and just rub our geek sensibilities the wrong way. And since this foray was Django's idea, I think Django should start off with the topic he needs to nitpick most about today.
Oh man, do I have to pick just one?
No, well, we have to start out.
Man, I'm sure we can get something.
Yeah, I'm sure we could weigh something in. Yeah, and you know, I want to make it clear, like, I love Star Wars. This is like one of my, probably my favorite universe that I am in the fandom of, in all of fandom. And so like, I just, you know, me and my friends as writers and world builders just always love talking about this stuff, even, you know, oh, that doesn't make sense or this doesn't make sense. But I don't want anyone to think I'm bagging on Star Wars. And so to start, you know, the not bagging on Star Wars. I'm going to go with in the new trilogy, a thing that I always was hazy on is like what the actual political reality of the post-Return of the Jedi, that is, world is. And I mean, Max was talking about this in a previous email thread about how the Empire's rise seems like shockingly fast for everyone to have forgotten about the Jedi and for there to be this sort of uniformity in culture. And so, you know, it's one of these things where it's like you can come up with theories as to like why this could be. Like, maybe there's a lot more variety in the galaxy than we actually see, and like we just focus on this like very narrow slice of things that can change really quickly. I don't know. Here's a question to the rest of the panel. Like, when you guys first saw Force Awakens, do you feel like you understood what like the political situation was vis-a-vis the New Republic, the Resistance, and the First Order?
You mean like how they got there from the end of Return of the Jedi?
Or even just like what was happening. I felt like we needed a little more in the opening crawl.
I don't think that's true. I think we were primed to want more because Star Wars has been such a massively expanded upon media franchise for the last however many years it's been. But I don't think the movie itself lacks any more context than the original Star Wars, which just launches you in with the Senate being dissolved and maybe there's an emperor somewhere, but there's no explanation of the status quo.
I feel
there's no explanation of the status quo, but like if you got passing familiarity with like Western history, the fact that we've got a Senate and an empire and some stuff is being dissolved, to me that puts us pretty strongly, and we're doing a space Rome kind of thing, and we got to worry about the space emperor who's subverting democracy, and that, like, that orients you pretty quickly. I feel like I understood what was going on in the prequel trilogy, but it's a lot less instantly relatable. You've got like space Sandinistas and splinter factions, and the Resistance is basically a plausibly deniable CIA interventionist op, like, if you want to look at it that way. Like, that, and these are not things that, like, there's a lot of, I don't know, mythologized history around. It's pretty weird stuff, really, even though it happens in the real world all the time.
It's that I felt like I was missing. I think part of it is that you've got the New Republic, right? So there's this, like, third thing. Like in the original trilogy, you get the Empire, you get the Rebels. Got it. That opening shot is such genius, right? Of the, you know, this is from the Red Letter Media review where you see like a little tiny Rebel ship and the giant Imperial ship just open up the camera and you're like, got it. It tells you everything you need. But like in the new one, there's the New Republic and the Resistance and the First Order. And now I'm like, wait. And like the answer, which they spelled out in the books and stuff, is that like the Republic and the First Order have a peace treaty, and so they're not officially allowed to fight. And then the Resistance is their like the Republic's like deniable front organization.
Oh, that's interesting. What? See what I got. And I'm curious as to what like what other people got from that opening, because where I thought things stood was we got the Republic, which is not fighting the Resistance, the First Order, because they just don't care, or because there are various political deadlocky forces that stop them from actually going out and fighting the First Order or protecting the Outer Rim, or they can't do force projection the way they'd like to, or whatever, all sorts of reasons. The First Order are an Imperial remnant. Some of those Commander Asard guys who are just hanging out on the edge of space, getting more and more insane and more like hyper-fasci as they get less and less control over actual territory. So they're willing to just do nutty stuff. And then the Resistance, right, are a combination of people in the Outer Rim who are stepping up against the First Order because the Republic isn't, and then Leia Organa and her loyalists from inside the New Republic who are going to ally and fight the Empire, because fighting empires is all they know how to do, really. Like, that's where I thought things stood. And that's not exactly what Django's saying.
Well, it's not far off from what I understand to be the canon. If there's a book, one of the Princess Leia books that goes into this, and it's basically that, like, the Republic fought the Imperial Remnant until politics happened and they got tired of it and they signed a peace treaty. And then Leia and some of the other hardliners are like, no, we got to keep going. And so they form this resistance as the First Order gets more and more angry. And, you know, sympathizers in the Republic help them, but not officially. That's how I understand it.
But I would argue that you shouldn't necessarily have to go to, like, material outside of the films to get that information,
agreed.
You know, because not everybody goes to read the books and not everybody watches the TV shows and not everybody sort of gathers the information outside of the film trilogy. So it is a flaw if people don't understand, like, why are there three different factions? And the New Republic doesn't even really play into the action of the new films.
Not as much, I don't think. I will say when Force Awakens starts, and they were like, you know, the New Republic, blah, blah, blah. But then you see Kylo Ren come through. I immediately thought, oh, the New Republic must be a joke. Because why would they let these guys do this stuff? They must be, you know, either, you know, they're inept, or maybe they don't have a standing fighting force, whatever it is. But they must be a joke, because how are you just going to let these guys? I mean, they have, like, ships and troops. And so that's, I assume, like, either A, the New Republic has all the government side, but they have no troops. And then, of course, the First Order has tons of troops, but they have no government. You know, their government is shut up and follow my rules.
So, wow. I was totally misunderstanding what the First Order was. My initial thought, the first time I saw Force Awakens, I thought the First Order was just a heavily populated, heavily armed, extremist faction of the Republic, kind of like Saw Gerrera was with the Republic. Like, yeah, he's a rebel, but we don't really talk to him or invite him to the cocktail parties. And I started to think of the split between the Republic and the First Order as kind of like what you had in Ireland. In the 70s, you have the radical Sinn Féin army, and then you have the rest of the political side, and you have the violent side and just messing things up for everybody. I'm like, wait, and now you're saying that's not how that was, and I'm so confused.
I often think we could have fixed this with like they could have put a line in the opening crawl, like, the exhausted Republic has signed a peace treaty with the Imperial Remnant. Now the First Order has emerged and is being evil again, but only Leia's resistance will stand up to them. And then, like, got it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, a simple explanation, which would have cleared up potential confusion, which is, like, there's no need to have any member of the audience go in confused to a Star Wars movie.
Yeah.
So, it's not like there's that
I will
much
ask this.
No, go for it.
I will ask this. When they blew up the what system?
No, I forget.
Oh, yeah, Coruscant and everything. No, it wasn't Coruscant.
No, it was Hosnian. Was it Hosnian Prime?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
cool. That's right. So when they blew up the Hosnian system, let's be, at least for me, I didn't care because we didn't know any. I feel like if maybe we had a movie before that we're like, oh, we've been on Hosnian. Mm-hmm. See the people, you know, in this system and they're peaceful and whatever and they're having a good time and not hurting anybody. And then, like, they're straight murdered. But it's I don't know if anybody cared.
I was legit annoyed when I learned, so annoyed when I learned that it wasn't Coruscant that got blown up that I have forgotten it and still don't remember it. Because when I saw it in the theater, I was like, holy shit, they just blew up Coruscant. I've read like 3,000 pages of Star Wars book minimum. Yeah. Set on that place, and I like I've set campaigns there. They just blew it up. This is some serious shit. And then it's like, oh no, it's another place that looks exactly it's like Coruscant. But don't worry, Chewie's still alive 2 minutes later. Like that, you know, taste of things to come, I guess.
I mean, that was kind of true though in the original trilogy, right? They blow up Alderaan, which we never see or.
But we see Leia. We see Leia and all the people who are like have family back on Alderaan, and it's like there's Leia standing there with like tears brimming in her eyes as she's watching.
Obi-Wan feels it.
Everybody's like nobody feels like you know. Compare the entire destruction of the Republic and the Republic Senate to. And like everybody's complete lack of emotional response to it, including like Leia, who presumably had friends back on that planet and everything. The 5 minutes following the death of Spider-Man in Into the Spider-Verse, right? Where like everybody's walking around New York with that sort of gut punch feeling. And granted, like by the time Spider-Verse came out, we all had a lot of a direct visceral experience of staring at our phones in terror to like connect with, but there was that like emotional reality missing from the Hosnian explosion, I thought.
Agreed.
Yes.
Was the Hosnian system mentioned in any of the books or the animated series that would have anchored that for any viewer of that movie?
I think retroactively, I'm not sure it had been previously.
Mm.
It's not even mentioned in the movie.
it's a big city planet.
Yep. Oh boy. So yeah, that's
that was you want to talk about nits. Like my legitimate I'd say like scientific maybe disagreement with JJ Abrams about how close planets are to one another.
He's really bad at that.
But across his thing.
Star Trek movies where Kirk is standing and watching Vulcan get consumed by the black hole, and it's a nice shot, but I'm like, what the hell is Kirk standing on?
And like, I get that there's some sort of, you know, dramatic and directorial license, and it looks really cool, which is the reason it's in the movie, but nevertheless.
Yeah. That's sort of neither here nor there.
Yeah, but I mean, at that moment, I was confused. I was finding myself sitting there like, wait, was that planet always in the sky? Was it in the sky because there's like some weird hyperspace thing going on with the Starkiller base thing? Is it like bridging? Is there a giant hollow screen that's now showing the Hosnian system getting blown up for some reason? Because the First Order wants to go, ha ha ha, we did the evil. Or
I'm not sure whether Starkiller base can move or not. That was not clear to me in Force Awakens.
And how this?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Starkiller base.
Because it's a planet.
The sun. Then what? Does the sun come back?
No, it doesn't.
What a great.
Oh yeah, they do say they move around and they suck up the sun for the energy. So yeah, it has to move. Maybe it just moves real slow.
You think? Like honestly, super weapon aside, if you could move a planet, that seems like kind of a big deal.
Yeah, just move planets into other planets. Just like start playing pool a little bit.
That's not a planet. That's a comet.
I love the thought that the sort of game balance of Starkiller Base is they spent all this time, spent all this money, built this huge thing, and it's only good for like shooting at stuff it happens to be aimed at because of orbital dynamics. And four shots in, it's not going to work anymore because the sun's dead.
That would be like fascists are not known for their like realistic forward planning. So they'll be like,
well, honestly, all they had to do was take out the. Well, I mean, they took out the New Republic, so they were, completed their mission. They were like, hey, New Republic's gone. We don't have anybody to complain about us no more. You know, I'm sure anyone that, you know, knows that we blew up like four planets at once, they ain't going to be talking no more, you know, because they know better.
Is that a problem of aiming, though? Because everyone on Batuu saw blast go by, but Batuu wasn't hit. I'm like, what, did somebody just not punch that planet in to calculate?
Mars is paying protection money is what's going on there.
There you go.
I guess I'll speak up in the movie's defense with a slightly heretical opinion.
Okay.
Awesome.
Which is that maybe the stuff happening on the screen doesn't have to be literally real. Documentary reel. Maybe the reason that Finn looks up in the sky and sees this giant red laser shooting across the galaxy in real time and is immediately like, holy shit, the First Order just blew up the Republic, is because narratively it's more interesting for him to see that in the sky from J.J. Abrams' very visually oriented head than to hear it on the radio or whatever.
Yeah.
And maybe these things Abrams is doing with his skyboxes, with putting stellar bodies really close to each other, are basically dramatic license. Like, he's rendering this scene in a visual way when really the information would pass in some other fashion. I don't know. I like to think about the idea that, I don't know, maybe I'm getting too postmodern, but
no,
not everything that happens in a story, especially in a movie, has to be driven by the diegetic logic of the world. Like, we're not observing a simulation. It's an artifact made by people. And things can happen. My favorite example of this is going all the way back to Han Solo saying that the Millennium Falcon can make the Kessel run in less than 12 parsecs or whatever. And of course, nerds in the expanded universe have come up with this elaborate theory canonized in Solo as to why Han Solo would say that his ship is fast because it can travel a shorter distance. The explanation, of course, is that because the ship has more powerful engines, it can get closer to this black hole cluster when it makes the run, and therefore cut off time. But in fact, if you look at the original script notes, Han is just bullshitting this kid.
Right.
Yeah.
No people know anything.
So Alex Guinness even looks at him skeptical.
100%.
And it's strange to me that we've had decades of expanded universe material and now this actual production explaining what Han really meant, when the real answer seems to be a basic one to his character. He's a liar.
I think he was
a tall tale teller too.
He was embellishing the results of a contest to make it sound like he achieved more than that particular contest actually gave him. That happens.
But it tells you a lot about his character too, like the original script note interpretation. It tells you that both he needs to be the best at absolutely everything and that he's, extremely clever in his pitching, but he's not particularly bright.
Right, because he doesn't know that this is bullshit. The thing that's funny to me, actually, is that the
Solo... Or he doesn't care that, like...
Still doesn't make sense. if you try to take Solo as an explanation of, like Han is literally... was making a correct statement, it's a bit like saying... I'm really fast because I ran the marathon in only 22 miles by taking a shortcut. And I'm like, it doesn't make you really fast.
I mean, I think that your point, Seth, about the over-reliance on diegesis in reading films like Star Wars is a really good one. I do think though that like nine, at the same time, I think that, seven, eight movies into a film series, at least I would find myself quite bound by the logic of presentation of the previous movies in the series, right? To my viewing, the original Star Wars trilogy is pretty diegetic. Like, you can watch, you can poke fun at, like, how much molten metal is going to rain down on Endor and how screwed are the Ewoks going to be. You can, like, get at it from a lot of these sort of side logical levels, but there's not much that I remember that's portrayed that is not at least just sort of on a first level or first order level, like diegetically plausible. I guess the closest you get are things like they can breathe on the asteroid, which they're missing, like this asteroid has atmosphere or something.
Everyone speaks English somehow.
Yeah, but for me, being able to see, given that the first time that we had a planet blown up on screen, we had a number of very elegant, to my mind, diegetic ways to get that information to the characters in a ways that felt very affecting. Like, it feels like we've kind of, feels like we're introducing new cinematic techniques if that's what we're intended to take from the narrative. Maybe I'm reaching too much here. I don't know.
Sure. I mean, I agree. I personally really don't like that Abrams distance cheating stuff, but...
I mean, my complaint is more, if you go full into the sort of postmodernist interpretation where things are not literal, it has a way of destroying tension that, especially in a kind of science fictional setting where we're not really familiar with all the elements, saying that things are not like literally what they look like on the screen can risk pushing us too far into the like anything can happen so there's no tension.
I can see that. Yeah, like when I'm watching Pi, I'm not thinking like, oh yeah, this guy actually has a tree growing out of his head or something.
Right.
But if I was watching a fantasy film, I might think that maybe this person actually does have a tree growing out of their head and they need to like prune it regularly when they go to the barber or something.
When you're watching Star Wars, like if a TIE fighter shoots once and the Star Cruiser blows up, you're like, well, it doesn't fit. And if that sort of thing is going to happen, then like our narrative tension is sort of out the window.
I mean, but that literally happens in Return of the Jedi. Like an A-Wing crashes into the Executor and it drives into the Star for some reason.
As one of my favorite bloggers pointed out, they actually carefully set this up by like, they have the shields down and then the shield generator's destroyed and then the Admiral.
Good point.
Oh no, we're super vulnerable right now.
Sure. But I think on the broader point of losing the ability to create stakes is that tension and stakes don't necessarily derive from the literal mechanics of the universe. Like, if you're playing a video game, there can't be any danger except that which has been programmed into the game. But in a film, things can happen for reasons that aren't always physically realistic. So you can argue with me about whether this is physics, but Anakin falling to the dark side. He basically, in the span of like 5 minutes of screen time, goes from, I'm going to arrest Chancellor Palpatine to literally murdering children. And that's not realistic. Like, he'd probably need some years of drug abuse and you know, psychological reconditioning to get to that point. But because we understand symbolically this idea of the dark side and that Anakin has had this anger in him, we're willing to accept that once he's stepped over this cliff into working for the Emperor, he's able to do anything because he's just become this like, I was about to go for a really extreme metaphor here, but yeah, fuck it, I'll go for it. He's become this like school shooter, this like person who is so deep. And we're willing to use our knowledge of like, people do go to these extremes to forgive the fact that in the film's realism, there's probably not really enough time for him to go from kneeling at Darth Sidious's feet to lightsabering the kids.
I guess it's one of those cases where it's a question of the story world setting up the conditions for the eventual development. And like once enough points have been spent in developing narrative potential, then large consequences are possible. So like in the Anakin case there, we spent a lot of time on Anakin in that film, on Anakin being angry, Anakin is willing to kill people, Anakin's going to do the things the Jedi can't, Anakin loves Padme and is feeling like he has no other choice, that he needs to save her. And then he has stopped his former masters and teachers from arresting the guy who he thinks has the secret to saving Padme's life, and has in the process fallen to the dark side and pledges himself. Like, that's a big move. And the momentum of that, with all of the pent up, like, Anakin's eventually going to betray the Jedi, Anakin's eventually going to betray the Jedi, like, as soon as he goes, we're willing to go with him as far into as much Jedi betrayal as you want.
Well, I mean,
so, like, no, that's work that's done already, I think.
But is that any different from Finn being terrified of the First Order, telling everyone he's terrified of the First Order, that something terrible is going to happen, then seeing a light in the sky and saying, holy shit, the First Order just blew up the Republic and everything is doomed? Like, are those all that meaningfully different?
No, I don't. So I don't think that they are. And that moment when I saw it in the theater worked for me on an emotional level and on a dramatic level, even while I was sitting there thinking, like, wait, what the fuck kind of solar system are we in right now? How does this work? I was trying to come up with reasons for it to fit together on a game level.
To sort of bring us back towards where we started, and what Mike was saying, I feel like while it's fun to nitpick the, like, where exactly are they standing that they can see this in the sky, the fact that we lack an emotional connection with these people on Hosnian Prime is actually more of a problem. That, mm-hmm. like, if the original movie had, you know, if the original trilogy had a less plausible visual setup, but retained the sort of emotional reaction of Leia, then we wouldn't be comparing them in this way, right?
Yep. Okay, so who has the next knit we need to pick?
I'll do it.
There you go.
Go for it.
Okay, so I'm not trying to do the new trilogy guys or the sequel trilogy, because I'm one of those people that I'm like, hey, we never expected to get new stuff anyway. And look what we got. We got things. But something that always bothered me is that in The Force Awakens, you have what seems to be some sort of awakening with Finn. We have definitely a super awakening with Rey. And then you have Poe. And from my perspective, when I was seeing it, I was like, oh, I think I get it. Since the Force has gone so far to the dark side, the Force is kind of like activating in these three people. These are going to be our three people. Because, and hang with me for a second, the Force does work in different ways as far as like Maz and then like Yoda or then like Luke. So I was thinking with Poe, since he's such a great, you know, such a great pilot, and he's the best pilot out of everybody, we would find out, say, in the second movie or technically the eighth movie or whatever, that I've always been a great pilot and I don't know why. Ah, that's part of the Force. And then Finn being able to break like mental holds and stuff and being able to kind of like snap out of trances or, you know, being able to like have the mental fortitude, I guess, was a way that he was naturally using the Force. And then, of course, Rey, more of the, I guess, traditional like fighter hero Force. And I was like, oh, cool. This is the kind of like the balancing. They're going to bring the Force to say like, yo, hey, look, it's been too much dark stuff. We got like the Force has to be balanced. So we're going to bring these guys up. But then after we're like, oh, well, it's kind of like Gladys Knight and the Pips, because these guys are kind of like, like, I was like, you want us to be interested in these three new people, but these three new people aren't really, I mean, they're doing things, but it's really about this one new person. So, because they're doing things, but it's really about this one new person, which I'm like, well, you just, maybe y'all kind of got me a little too hype in the first one, mm-hmm. but then also we're ping-ponging the story and who's writing it back and forth and things of that nature as well. And Don't Sleep, I do like number 8, but that's something that really kind of got me about this trilogy is like, wow, I really wanted to see more, I guess, maturation of the Force in Finn and Poe, because we did get a piece of the Force tingle music. I don't know if that's if that's a term, but you know, like the Force tingle music with both of them as well. But then it kind of like nothing happened.
Yeah, I think Finn got that really bad.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the movie, they've got these scenes in the last one where he's like, ah, I always wanted to tell you something, Rey. And I'm pretty sure they were going to set up him being like, ah, I can feel the Force. But then they forgot to put that scene in the movie.
I have so many issues because I had so much hope that with, you know, like what Mike said, the
rebellions are built on hope.
Yes.
Sorry.
Rey was strong with the Force, but Finn was sensitive to it. I thought we were going to loop back around to the scenario we had in Phantom Menace, where you had a wide array of people who weren't Sith Lords, of people who weren't Skywalkers, who could sense and manipulate the Force. I thought we were going back to that. There are many people in the galaxy, in the universe, that have abilities with the Force, varying levels from barely sensing ants to being able to move entire ponds or whatever. And I thought that's where we were going with that. And when it looped back around to everybody is descendant, everybody who can, you know, who is strong with the Force is descendant from these two family lines. I'm like, really?
Did none of the other Jedi of the Old Republic have kids? Like, are there no other family lines? There's right. No family line.
Well, they did spend a lot of time killing all Sith.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah.
No. I was just like, Ki-Adi Mundi has like 6 grandkids who you know are running around out there somewhere, unless they've been Order 66 or whatever. Anyway, yeah, please continue.
The Order 66, and then there was like tons of people being conscripted into being like Darth Vader's, I don't know, semi minions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you go to the cartoons in Star Wars Rebels, they have a whole bunch of Force sensitive people as the Inquisitors, but probably let's stick to the movies. Complicated. I was gonna say, it has always been clear that like there's the Force that the Jedi use to like throw rocks and sword fight. But it's also this sort of narrative destiny force that moves people around. And so, like, I feel like people can be subject to the Force without literally having Jedi powers, right? And so, like, in some sense, it also just means, like, destiny. But I do agree that Episode 7 did the best of the new trilogy of, like, balancing the three of them. So they all had interesting things to do that I cared about all those stories, and then in the later ones, not so much.
But at least in The Last Jedi, you get more of what Mike was talking about, where you get this implication, at least, that the Force is something that's going out to more people than just the main characters. You know, there's at least an implication of that life beyond people who are related to Palpatines or Skywalkers.
Yes.
Yeah, how many people wanted to see that little kid with the broom actually in later stories as someone who's growing up who could potentially be a Jedi? I know I did.
Yeah, I mean, I'm did
sure too. It'll be in a book somewhere.
I would have been extremely on board with that, but like more than even just that particular kid is, I think, the implication that there are people all around the galaxy who at the end of The Last Jedi are looking up and thinking differently about their space and getting in touch with something that's so much bigger than they are. And that's the potential. And it would have been really cool to see a Rey, for my money anyway, to see a Rey who was not a mysterious space princess, but was trying to figure her way out and figure out what it meant to be a Jedi in this world. Or what it meant even to just be in touch with the Force, whether she thought of herself as a Jedi or not. try to gather those folks and lead them, teach them. That would have been a really cool story space. I don't know if you could have done it in a movie because that's a lot of ground to cover, but
yeah, I think that's
fun to try.
One of the points, though, that they're making in The Last Jedi that really landed for me, that I love about that movie, is that, you know, when Yoda talks to Luke at the end, he's saying, look, the Force is there. Like, the Jedi teachings are a particular way of understanding and manipulating it. But, like, the actual Force is still there whether the Jedi teachings are taught or not. Right, and then other people can feel it and interact with it in their own ways. It's not something they went back to. I would have loved to see someone more on that, but.
Well, that was the, Mike, I'm actually curious to know what you thought of the scene in Last Jedi when it's implied that Rey is a nobody, right? Kylo Ren says, you're nobody, right? Your parents are nobody, like, there's nothing special about you. Is that, like, what you were looking for in terms of, you know, this is not just going to be about like Force royalty?
Actually, I thought it was kind of cool because I was like, okay, cool. Because we had this idea that, oh, her parents are definitely super duper special. You know, it's going to be basically like Luke again. It's going to be like, oh, yo, you know, your parents are tight and you're going to have skills too. And now it's like, oh, word, anyone can, you know, anyone born somewhere, whatever planet or whatever, might be like super imbued with the Force or whatever, or sensitive to the Force. And then we kind of turned it back. But I know there's two factions of Last Jedi. There's people that love it. I know there's people that hate it. But then I also know that the internet is like this. Give us new stuff. Give them new stuff, give us old stuff.
So true.
So, you know, there's parts of the thing that gets me about Last Jedi is Poe, but as far as her being a nobody, I was like, you know what? That's some cold comfort for her. Having these powers and thinking, oh, I must be special. It's like, you ain't nobody. You ain't nobody. And I'll kill you where you stand. You better join me. I was like, that's cool. That's cool for her to be deflated because you got your hopes up. Oh man, there's this, you know, I'm gonna, you know, I got Luke and you know, gonna do all these great things. And then you find out that nah, it's nothing special about you at all. Now, of course, they did curve it back, but,
but I love that moment though. Like, I loved it being like, because it's not just there's nothing special about you, because that's Kylo's line also, right? Like, and he's a suspect narrator there a little bit. He's got his agenda in the situation. But also, like, that comes after a movie where Rey has been exposed to, like, what's actually going on with all these people. Two movies, really. Like, we've seen Han and Leia's broken marriage. We've seen Luke kind of fucked up by his life. I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say that on YouTube. Luke messed up by his life and his situation, his choices. And she's like, it's not any kind of this, all that magic hero sheen has been peeled back, or a lot of it has. And she knows the people now, the reality underneath the battered up rebel fighter pilot hat that she was putting on, helmet that she was putting on back in the first movie. So then all of a sudden it's this responsibility and opportunity. Like, none of these people, I come from a messed up family. I come from basically nothing and people tearing each other about and selling their kids for scraps and liquor. But so do basically all the rest of these people. So like, fuck, I'm going to save the galaxy. Why not? I thought that was a cool move. I mean, I get people didn't, and I get especially after the major buildup and Episode 7, why it struck people the wrong way, you know, because it was like, oh, Vader's lightsaber, is it Obi-Wan, is it whatever? But I don't know, that was a cool moment for me.
And they had, what was his name? Palpatine's puppet. He was like, bring me the girl. He was like, yo, I want this girl. She must be super special because even he wants her. Like, everybody wants this girl. And then it's like, nah, you ain't nobody. Then it's like, oh, no, psych, you are somebody.
I love that bit as well, also because it just works so well in the theme of the movie that, you know, and that moment where Kylo Ren tells her that she's nobody, he means it as an insult almost, that it's sort of psychological abuse. But like, when you look at it from our perspective, you know, Rey is the one who's actually free of this, at least at the end of that movie, right? She's right. Free of this like Skywalker Palpatine drama that has consumed the galaxy. Whereas like Kylo's attachment to Darth Vader is like weighing him down like a chain. That's the genius of that part. I love that part of that movie. It's funny, I have some issues with Last Jedi, but I feel like they're not the issues that anyone else has. I love that stuff. I love Luke's stuff. And Rey and all that. And then I'm like, but TIE fighters don't work that way, guys.
Yeah. Like the Luke, like Luke being a crusty old sort of paranoid hippie.
Totally down.
I would not have expected it, but I love it.
But don't you think, see, I've actually had this discussion, like all you guys, I'm sure you've had discussions like this multiple times, but I always argue that like the way Luke is in Last Jedi is perfectly logical if you look at the person he was at the beginning of Star Wars. Of course he ran away. Of course, because he tried to run away from it so many times. Of course he decided, oh, I made this one mistake, now I have to go to a planet. What do both of his teachers do?
Yeah.
He learned that from Obi-Wan and Yoda.
Yeah, I guess the only thing, Last Jedi, I liked how Luke was, except throwing the lightsaber. I would have reworked that scene where he held the lightsaber, and you could kind of see the weight of the lightsaber and the history of lightsaber on his face, and then him slowly just give it back to her and walk away. Like, this isn't my life. Because the rest of the movie, you can see him saying, this isn't my life. I lost it. I was wrong. I tried to do it. I sucked at it. And you know, and then of course Yoda had to come in and be like, look, get your stuff together. This girl needs you, stupid. Like, do what you got to do. But the real thing about Last Jedi is Poe. Since I have many family members that are in the military and friends that are in the military or have been in the military, there is no way any military organization is going to let you get away with all that. And then be like, well, I guess we'll put you back in charge again.
Poe literally gets all his friends killed. He badgers Odo until she tells him the plan with the transports. And then
random mutiny.
Tells Finn the plan over a hot mic, and it gets leaked to the Empire and they all die. Yeah. Like that's what happens. Like his complete lack of operational security and understanding of it is responsible for the death of 95% of the rebellion.
I love Poe, but he probably should have been shot.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, like much earlier in that movie too. So this is a thing that I have. I cannot justify the hot mic thing. I cannot justify that. I feel like there must have been. This is my like extreme no prize bullshit coming out. So advanced warning here. But I feel like there must have been a plotline cut. And the plot line that I think is missing is the mole hunt plot line on the Rebel cruiser while Rose are hunting for the hyperspace tracking hacker guy. And the reason for this is so many of the weird decisions in that film are decisions that come, like the fact that we have hyperspace fuel now, the fact that shots arc in space, the fact that we have slow bombers that have to sort of come over things and need to be defended by faster fighters. They're all like Rian Johnson going back and watching a whole bunch of World War II movies and pulling, just like George Lucas did when he was like, I see all the like old World War II movie influences that are all condensed into Last Jedi. And I think like the secret, one of us is a secret Nazi plot must have been one of those, especially since Donald Gleason, Hux. So Hux is like not acting on the bridge of the spaceship after the rebels get away, after the resistance gets away. He's not acting like somebody who has a secret tracking beacon device. He's not acting like somebody who knows that they're going to activate their hyperspace tracker and be able to follow the rebels wherever. He's like, Supreme Leader Snoke, we have them on the edge of a string. Let me go and tell you about it in private. Like, if he's not talking to his command staff about an operational capability he has, he's going to talk to his boss about a secret agent. And so all of a sudden, and that section right after, we cut to Finn being on the spaceship. So like, it was so clear to my wife when she was watching it. She was like, I spent the whole movie thinking that Finn was secretly a traitor or had some like tracking beacon in him. And they established that people can carry these hyperspace tracking beacons, that they're small and they're like, you can wear them on your wrist. When we introduce Holdo, she's wearing forearm covering gloves. They're thin gloves, but you could have something under those gloves, you know? Like,
yeah. Because they could have been like, hey, we tag all of our troopers and this dummy left it in. They have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then all of a sudden, Poe being like so suspicious of Holdo for no reason makes a little bit of sense if what he's thinking is, there's a mole. Someone sold us out. Someone is continuing to sell us out. I need to find who. Everything's pointing out Holdo. We never get any proof in the film at all that the hyperspace tracking thing exists. Yeah. We never get any proof positive that it exists.
Yeah, by the time they go to shut it down, it doesn't matter anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because when I first saw that, I thought they were setting up something like, all right, how many people remember the episode 33 from the new Battlestar Galactica?
Yeah.
I thought that's what we were going to end up with. But we end up with literally a treasure hunt on a planet that lasts way too long for no reason. I'm like, what are we doing? I don't get it.
What they were learning, or what I guess Rose was learning is, or no, not Rose, what Finn was learning is that all that glitters ain't gold, but that was a long way around the block to learn that lesson. And I think he could have learned it differently.
And what did
and still go to the same planet, but just learn it differently.
Yeah, but what was the outcome of that in regards to what happened when he got back and they had to go to the planet and defend him from his security breach?
Like, I don't feel like Finn's character, like a flaw that he needed to overcome was he's too impressed by wealth and power. Like, that's not a thing I got.
Good point. Good point.
So, like, why is this a lesson that we need to teach him?
I don't know that it was necessarily a lesson for Finn. I felt like Rian Johnson's trying to do something to introduce, like, you know, this sort of gray morality, which is really not present in the Star Wars films overall. And actually, that's my part of my nitpick, is that things tend to be very black and white. And you don't have this idea that, like, there are people out there that aren't good or bad, you know, but they're profiting off the war and things like that. But it is a long way to introduce that idea. But I like the ambition of trying to introduce this kind of third morality into the series that I think it really needs.
I think
that, yeah, because it was a long way before they got to that shit where it was like, look, they selling this stuff to them and you. So mm-hmm. What you think? He was like, do you see these people? Do they look like there's a war going on? Does it look like the 1%? Does it look like the 1% is worried about anything that's going on in your rat race of a life?
And this is one of the things where we never see the core worlds really in the original Star Wars. We see the Outer Rim. We see places where things are messed up, where the Empire is struggling to exert control. We don't see the people who are safe. And that was something that was, for me, cool to see. For me, I didn't think it was so much that Finn needed to get the wool pulled off from his eyes with regards to the glitz and glamour of everything. I see Finn as an extremely, as a guy who's had a very simplistic kind of brainwashy education that, you know, there are the good guys and the bad guys, and we're the bad guys, and we got to go kill the good guys. And then when he's a good guy now, all of a sudden, he's still got that worldview. And that's very similar to the worldview of somebody who's just sort of coming in watching the Star Wars films. Like, oh, there's good guys and bad guys. And Finn goes, and he's like, first of all, we get to the planet where there's the casino, and he sees all these people who are living really well, and he's into the fact that they're living well, because he's a poor kid, you know? He's, like, never had luxury before, I think. And then he's, like, discovers or is told that things are a lot more complicated than they first appeared to him. For me, that's cool. Now, I agree that the timing feels like it doesn't quite jive, right? Like, they're chasing, we got a spaceship chase where, like, fighters are blowing up and people are dying and everything. And meanwhile, there's time for him to go to this planet and come back from and, like, get running around a little bit. It's just, that's where I start to have some difficulty.
I'm with Max on that one. Although it ties back a little to what we were saying before, which is that seeing the situation on the casino planet would be more impactful if we knew what the sort of political situation of the galaxy at that time was, especially post Starkiller Base. Like, is there a government? Like, is anyone in charge? Is the First Order just, like, running the galaxy now, and these guys are all collaborators? Are they just, like, rich guys who don't give a crap? Like, I don't know, looking at them. I don't know, you know, are they partying while Rome burns and the Star Destroyers are going to turn up and execute everyone soon? Like, I don't know any of this.
Well, Christina, did you get all of your point that you wanted to knit?
Oh, I mean, I have sort of a general frustration with this idea that characters cannot be redeemed except by death in the Star Wars series. Obviously, like, in the original series, I guess you can sort of give it a pass because Lucas was building something that was very binary, you know, and it was clearly like, this is good, this is bad. But, like, the later movies especially, it's like, you can't, like, why can't Kylo Ren be redeemed? Why does he have to sacrifice himself in order to be redeemed? Like, why can't there be the possibility of someone actually having to face the consequences of what they've done? I think probably I started thinking about this because I watch a ton of anime, and I know Django does too. And if you watch anime, there's an astounding number of anime in which seemingly unredeemable villains become good guys by the end of the series because they face what they've done, and then they've had to repent.
To the point where sometimes it can become a problem.
Well,
hanging out with their new buddies, and I'm like, do we not remember all the genocide that guy did, like, last week?
But it would be nice to see the series, to see at some point, to see people grapple with, like, things that they've done wrong in a more realistic way. Even Luke, right? Luke has this one moment where he thinks about killing his nephew. So the only way he can redeem himself in this series is to valiantly sacrifice himself at the end of Last Jedi, right? By death. Kylo, all the stuff he's done wrong, he can only redeem himself by death. Darth Vader, only redeem himself by death. Even all the characters in Rogue One.
He killed younglings.
Even all the characters in Rogue One, right? Like, Diego Luna's character gives this big speech about how we've all done bad things, and so we're going to go and help you with this seemingly impossible task. And of course, they've all done bad things, even though it was in the name of good, so they all have to die on this planet.
Well, that was also continuity. They had to go. Like, look, you are not going to mess up the rest of this stuff yet.
I agree that it makes the most sense that he has to die in the case of Vader, because Vader has literally given up his humanity itself, right? Mm-hmm. He's become this machine thing that you can't imagine him just, like, living a normal life.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't apply in most of these other cases. So I feel like they're just kind of following the trope.
You can't see him rolling up to the Skywalker barbecue, visit the grandkids.
Yeah. he's got like a wheelchair and like an assisted breathing thing.
I was just going to say, the problem is that maybe it doesn't have to, but it's like it never really comes to grips with the nature of the evil that it's constantly presenting, you know? And I find that frustrating, that like there's no way for people to repent. There's no way for people to find a better way. It's like once you've made this left turn, you can never get out of the forest. You're stuck there, and you know there's no hope for you.
So, sorry, do you mind if I jump in?
Mm-hmm. Go.
I was about to reference something you were saying earlier, so I'm curious as to whether you're gonna. Yeah, go for it.
This actually leads me to one of my big nitpicks with the Star Wars fan base. I think we're all really good at identifying things that. Like facts and trivia that aren't even in the movies. Like everybody knows what an X-Wing is. And that line, I think X-Wings are called X-Wings once in Empire. Same with TIE Fighters, they get called TIE Fighters once in Jedi. Everybody knows what an Ewok is, even though that word is never used. We're all pretty good at recalling like the biographical data of Star Wars. But I think Star Wars fans are really bad at recognizing things that to me are said very directly in the themes. Like if you ask Star Wars fans, and this is jumping off your thing about redemption and what the right way to deal with Vader or Kylo is. If you ask Star Wars fans in general, in the same way you would ask them, what is Luke's fighter called? Were Obi-Wan and Yoda people who supported Luke's journey or got in the way of it? Did Luke need to learn lessons from them or reject them? I think you would get a range of answers. And I think most people would say Obi-Wan and Yoda were cool. But to me, if you watch the original three movies, the screaming lesson is that Obi-Wan and Yoda suck. And that Luke wins in the end by ignoring everything they tell him. They repeatedly tell him over and over, you have to kill your dad. Your dad sucks. He's never coming back. There's nothing left in him. The only hope for the galaxy is for you to go in there and murder Darth Vader. And at the end, he doesn't. And, like when you're talking about redeeming villains and giving them a chance, what Luke does at the end of Jedi is one of the most radical things in the whole Star Wars universe. He just puts his weapon down and it's like, no, I'm not going to fight. And as a result, the evil forces arrayed before him kind of destroy themselves. But that's not what he was taught to do. It's not what he was told to do. It to me suggests that, and once you recognize that, you kind of have to look at the prequels as a story about how much the Jedi sucked.
Yeah.
And
which actually makes them make way more sense.
Yeah.
Like thematically they make much more sense that way.
I think I had a bounce on the prequels. I love that point, Seth. I think it's really, really great. One way that I've tried to approach my understanding of people really bouncing off of Luke's representation in The Last Jedi is that when I was watching the prequels for the first time, when I was like, I don't know, young teenager, I had a pretty hard jump bounce off of their depiction of the Jedi because the Jedi in the prequels do suck. And that I felt let down by it. And it took me a while to be able to work through what was actually important to me, what worked so well in the original trilogy, which is the slow demonstration that Obi-Wan and Yoda, whatever else they are trying to impart to Luke that Luke takes on board and Luke runs with and that is really cool, they don't understand what needs to happen right now. Like that their way is not able to stop Vader, is not able to stop the Emperor, and Luke does need to grow beyond them, and he does. And so the prequels are a tragedy. And then in that light, Luke's own story has a sort of tragedy. Like what Luke is able to do or become is not, he's unable to grow beyond the Jedi as much as he needed to in order to meet the challenge of Kylo Ren falling to the dark side or whatever.
That's a great interpretation for Last Jedi, where you think of it as Luke having achieved something at the end, this sort of moment of transcendence at the end of Return of the Jedi, is then asked to train a bunch more Jedi,
and
terrified of doing it wrong, runs back to the teachings of his masters who manifestly fail.
Yeah, that's why I think it's so great. And that's, I think, where he comes from, just being so down on the Jedi by this beginning of Last Jedi, because he's Luke is a transcendent mystic. He's like the guy who goes out into the desert and sort of achieves a self-sacrificial vision. You know, that's where he gets at the end of Return of the Jedi. And what he's asked to do and challenged to do in the wake of Return of the Jedi is be a church builder. You know, he's called to be, you know, Saul on the road to Damascus. And that's a whole different job. That's a whole different universe. And he's bad at it. He's great at the thing he needed to do, but he's bad at this. And that's like really cool tragedy to me.
That's something that, you know, a lot of people, when I have discussions with them, you know, we always talk about how bad Jedi are. But in a couple of conversations, and here it came back up again, is my thought of, it's not that so much that the Jedi are like horrible or they suck or they failed, like, you know, like Luke said, the Jedi lost their way because they were trying to be something they weren't. Mm-hmm. They were never supposed to be a fighting force. So now you're trying to make a hammer do what a screwdriver does.
Yeah, totally.
So now they're trying to operate outside of, you know, I guess for lack of a better word at this time, their gift. So their gift is to do this. So they're trying to like modify their gift to come over here. And it kind of is okay, but that's not what they're supposed to be doing. And then they further lose their way because they're essentially out of pocket. And then back to Christina, I do think there's a pretty interesting story to be told about Kylo Ren trying to, I guess, kind of like work his debts off, you know, to society by either, you know, training or assisting Rey or, you know, maybe even finding a way to carry on his mother's mission and what she stood for before. I think there is a story there to be told. And, you know, kind of trying to buy your way into heaven, if you will. I think there's a good story there to be told. Jedi's... Oh, go ahead.
No, finish.
Oh, I think the Jedi's main issue is they're always getting caught up and trying to be something that they're not.
Yeah.
And
the prequels are all about how the Jedi aren't cops. They shouldn't be cops.
Yeah.
And Lucas was always a really political director. Sorry, I'll be really quick. And obviously, Nixon and Vietnam were really formative for Star Wars. And I think a lot of the prequel intrigue with the Jedi, like trying to figure out who the evil Dark Lord is really basically about exactly what you said. How incredibly out of place these Buddhist monks are trying to like be space detectives and go to the diner and talk to this guy about, you know, where'd this dart come from? Oh, it came from Kamino. Just all this cop stuff. The Jedi shouldn't be doing that. It's not good for their spirits.
I think one of my problems with the prequels is that interpretation makes way more sense than what we're given, but the tone of the movie doesn't support it. That the tone, you know, the music, the framing, the dialogue, everything in the prequels supports the idea that the Jedi are uncomplicatedly heroic and we are supposed to root for them and be sad when they die. And that the bad guys are uncomplicatedly evil and we are supposed to root against them and be sad when they win.
Wait. Did you see Phantom Menace?
I did see Phantom Menace.
The part where Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon roll up at the beginning and they're going to go to some diplomatic meeting and they're totally stiff and unlikable. Then they go to this planet and the slaves are like, hey, we're slaves. We have bombs in our heads. Can you do anything? And they're like, no.
No.
Absolutely not. Can't help you.
That's the thing, right? Like, you would think, and the fact that like Anakin doesn't go back and rescue his mother in the 10 years between episode 1 and 2, he's just like, yeah, she's just a slave. It's fine.
He's not allowed to because the Jedi suck.
Right. But but I feel like that.
Because they really were like, it's not our thing. But then it's like, but aren't you fighting for like the light?
Yeah.
Are we determining where the light should shine?
Taxation.
Why is there still slavery when the Jedi are running the galaxy? I mean, they're not literally running the galaxy, but
yeah, you know,
I know what you mean. But yeah, I feel like it's just not in the, it's not part of the story that they're telling. It's not framed that way. So like we can make that interpretation, but like it's not in there, and that frustrates me so much because I really want it to be.
I want to just pull out the amazing John Williams score and pull in like Chinatown and some shit, and
right?
Some filters on it and see how noir you can get the actually pretty bleak script of the first of the prequel trilogy by adjusting levels and direction.
That would be that would be amazing if someone wants to recut episode one and like, you know, work it over and make it, you know, I don't know, Raymond Chandler. That'd be great.
I mean, I can recommend, there's this YouTube channel called Aural Knots. Uh-huh. Aural is in relating to sound. They've done this great recut of the entire Star Wars saga. I don't think they've done the sequels yet, but it starts with episode one, Jedi Party. And it's about a group of Jedi going to, I think it's Space Hooters. And they just trash the place, totally wreck it. So regional manager Darth Maul has to be dispatched to like deal with the problem. And it goes on from there. It's kind of disparity what you're talking about. The best line is when little Anakin is like, Master Qui-Gon, I've been wondering, what are midichlorians? He says, it's heroin.
Oh my goodness. So now I am confused. If the Jedi are not supposed to be trying to bring peace to the galaxy in the face of the great evil that is the Imperial Senate, whatever it is, what's the purpose of the Sith Lords?
Well, actually, this goes back to what I was saying. I'm pointing the wrong way again. what I was saying is that the Jedi have lost their way. That's assuming they were ever good in the first place, right? We're told that.
Good point.
Right? But it's all the Jedi telling us. They're all telling us the Jedi Order used to be great. And, you know, maybe they were always bad. Maybe the point is that this thing that Luke is sort of perfecting and moving past this flawed creation that he is given.
I'm going to be a little bit of a demiurge here and pretend to speak for George Lucas, but I think that given George Lucas's influences, his idea of what really good Jedi would be would basically be like wandering Ronin or samurai, where they're just going around the galaxy righting wrongs, not living in a temple in luxury, and I don't know.
Or, I mean, you can think of them as like Shaolin monks and those kinds of orders, historically speaking. There have been moments, and certainly fictionalized moments, where you have the like monk who's wandering around and righting wrongs, or who is sort of drifting from place to place in a kind of high plains drifter kind of way. But also there are historical moments where those orders become extremely corrupt and become centers of power and become centers of authority external to government, where they foment rebellion all on their own. And that is something, that's a moment that I feel like we're seeing in the prequels. We're seeing like a Jedi order that has left its sort of Ronin roots, or even its peaceful mendicant roots, to be like laser sword space cops who are being deployed by Capital to oversee the appropriate flow.
Do we know they used to be mendicants?
We don't. This is kind of, I think, maybe to Seth's point earlier, but we have where they're framed,
right,
in costuming, in rhetoric and style, in a way that suggests that they are wandering Ronin, basically. We don't know a lot, but this is the framing that we get from the original trilogy, and then it becomes kind of weird in the prequel trilogy and the others, right? Because we start off with Obi-Wan wearing desert person robes because
they all wear those for some reason.
And then it turns out that he's been wearing a Jedi uniform for the last 30 years.
Cleverly hiding from Darth Vader on Darth Vader's home planet within walking distance of his house. And
you had to hide in plain sight.
Wearing an official Jedi robe, and he changed his first name from to Ben.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But otherwise, he's under.
Old Ben? Old Ben Kenobi?
Now that's interesting thing, because like we have the Sith Lord and their protege. What if the Jedi started out like that? You had one Jedi and one protege, but somewhere along the line, they found a whole bunch of people who were force sensitive, and the idea to form a government and a bunch of schools came about, and that actually led to the corruption of the Jedi way, and they basically ended themselves.
See, God, I wish the prequels were actually about that. Like, you can infer these things, but, like, that's not what's there.
Yeah, because there is like, this sense of, even when I, like, review other movies or TV shows, there's this idea of sometimes we're reviewing what we saw, and then sometimes we're reviewing the cool stuff we project onto it. Like, oh, and this happened, and it's like, well, that didn't really happen. You're kind of projecting what you think this character, but that character didn't do that. Kind of thing.
And Star Wars complicates that a little bit, since there's so much supplementary material and extended universe material where, you know, various authors get to, in a quasi-canon way, do that projection for themselves.
Right. It's really hard to tease out what is Star Wars and what's Timothy Zahn, or what's the various West End Games source books, or, like, you know, I have over there a bunch of long boxes of Dark Horse, Knights of the Old Republic, Tales of the Old Republic comics.
Nice.
Those are real Star Wars for me, and I don't know how many other people read them, but vanishingly small percentage compared to the number of people who saw any of the movies, or even like the holiday special, probably.
Yeah, and my favorite Star Wars character was actually born out of Heir to the Empire. My favorite Star Wars character, you know, is Thrawn.
He was part of the previous continuity.
Yeah. Because Heir to the Empire is pretty sweet. But it's now it's kind of one of those things where it's like, oh, this, like, they, what was the line where he said, there's always some truth to legends or something like that? So I was just like, oh, you know, this may have happened. You know, kind of like, but very cool audiobooks. Check them out.
Those books are amazing. Like, that was probably how I got into Star Wars as a fandom instead of just as a set of movies. Was definitely the Zahn books.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, they came out at just the right time, I think, for the re-release of A New Hope in theaters. Around then, I don't remember. I was a kid.
I know. I had A New Hope on some, like, battered VHS.
So before I lean in with a comment on the original trilogy, did everyone get their nitpicks in?
Mm-hmm.
We feel better. Okay.
But we can go forever.
Oh, we can go. We can go.
I have prequel nitpicks too. But, you
know. We can dive. I know the prequel into that.
Don't we all?
We can because I, like I said, I am a huge fan of the, you know, political Machiavellian flavored ploy that was the Phantom Menace. I just that was so succulent, and then the, you know, chapters 1 and 2 just went completely, not even a left turn. They did a 180 on me. I'm like, wait. Anyway, the original trilogy, what we older folks consider the original trilogy, A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi. What do you prefer, the original cuts or the special edition?
The original.
Yeah, the original cuts, no question.
Yeah. OG, I like the THX remasters. Not the new effects ones, but like the blaster bolt touch-ups and things that they did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a few
from over here.
There's a few touch-up pieces that I don't mind, that, like, when they added more X-wings in the fight scenes or whatever, sometimes they, like when the TIE fighters, if you're looking in, if you're watching it on Blu-ray and the TIE fighter shots, you can see the matting.
Yeah. Because
it's, the colors are slightly different. And I know one of them, you know, digitally cleaned that up. But all those like extra musical numbers and like all the extra CG crap,
yeah,
doing it. Oh God. So much.
That's better. Why it's like, it's kind of a mixed bag. There's some stuff that's like, oh, cool. Oh, that was nice. Nice to, you know, clean that up and add that in. That's a great idea. And then there's some stuff where it's like, but would we ever have these musical numbers to make fun of?
Yeah. They did not exist. True. Okay, sorry, did you want to go, Seth?
No, I'm laughing.
Oh, yeah, no. The for me, the only positive that came out of the special editions was making the Cloud City, Bespin, brighter. I mean, this is a city in the clouds. Mm. This is a city that's closer to the sun. It should be shining, you know. And in that remaster, I was like, okay, this is what Bespin should have been like all along. But the only copies of Star Wars, the original trilogy saga that I bought the big 9-disc remaster on Laserdisc, and then I had the individual movies on Laserdisc. I was very, very sad when my Laserdisc player started dying. I got rid of all my Laserdiscs about five, six years ago, but I was able to make myself personal digital copies from the Laserdiscs. So until Disney decides, you know what, we're going to milk this Star Wars cow for a lot more money and release the original versions too, I am not buying Star Wars Empire Strikes Back or Return of the Jedi on disc. That's my story and I'm sticking to it.
I tell you one thing that I actually, thinking about it, kind of love. So, I mean, we all know the sort of Han shoots first, Greedo shoots first thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, change that. Special editions. Then they came out with another edition on Disney Plus, and they apparently changed it again. I haven't actually watched it, but they changed it. So now they kind of shoot at the same time.
Really?
Yeah.
And like, I'm like, someone on Twitter, I think it was Felix Gilman, suggested like, they should just change it every edition. So this becomes this like weird mythological thing that everyone who's ever watched these movies can legitimately disagree about because we've all seen different versions. And it raises this event to the status of myth, right? That like nothing can ever truly be known.
And that's it.
Kind of love that.
We could tell which edition we're watching by seeing that scene. It's like, who shot first? Did they both shoot first? Did Greedo? Did Han? And for me, you know, Han shoots first, period. End of story.
Yeah, because it actually helps out with, you know, kind of like Christina was saying with, you know, usually it's all good or all bad. Now you have this guy who's, you know, narcissist, all in it for himself. You know, put 100 on 10, you know, and they're like, oh, I did it, you know, I did it this fast. Oh, well, you know, I did it this fast. And then shooting somebody first before they, it's like, I'm here to get you. Yeah, whatever, pal. And, you know, but then at the same time, it's like, all right, well, you know, this girl is pretty cute. Let me help out. So it's like, he's done some good stuff and he's on the run. But so, but then they were like, nah, let's take out the shooting first thing. Let's make it reactionary, and it's just like, well, I mean, I guess that still works, but
I just want to say,
go ahead.
Just real quick, when we're talking about the originals, I think one of the reasons besides nostalgia to hang on to the original cuts as the definitive ones is that there are many, many superlatives you can apply to Star Wars, you know, most money-making franchise or whatever. But one of the ones that deserves the most is that it probably is the best edited movie of all time. The editing of the original Star Wars A New Hope is flawless. And there's this fantastic video called How Star Wars Was Saved in the Edit that basically walks you through some of the original older cuts of the movie before the theatrical release and why they sucked. And one of the most astonishing things in this is that the entire iconic conclusion of Star Wars A New Hope, where they have to blow up the Death Star before it blows up the moon with Leia and all the rebels on it, is totally synthetic. It was not shot. It is assembled in the edit bay from other footage. So in the original script is shot, the rebels go out to destroy the Death Star, but it's not coming to destroy the rebel base. all of the Rebel base stuff was added in with dubbed over dialogue. So you'll never see Leia on screen talk about the Death Star coming to destroy them. You'll just see voiceover of shots of her looking concerned. And then all those infographics with like showing the Death Star moving around the planet are edited in to create the impression that, you know, the Death Star is coming. And it's incredible how perfect the illusion is. Mm-hmm. That like the movie was scripted to go this way with them racing against time to stop the Death Star, when in fact that was invented after the movie had been shot. So I really recommend that video because it's fantastic. And it helped me as a writer because I realized I didn't have to make my first drafts all that good.
You'll definitely have to send me a link to that so I can share it, because that sounds a lot like I had heard a story that Empire Strikes Back was completely rewritten by Lee Brackett. And that's how we got such a fabulously better story.
Yeah, unfortunately, none of those people, the extra writers who helped or the original editors were around for the prequels.
Yes. Alas.
I have my issues with the red letter media sort of ecosphere, but I do think that there is something powerful to be taken away from the difference between George Lucas as an immensely creative and very political director working with a whole bunch of people who felt, if not co-equal to him, at the very least, like they had full voiced ability to push back and change things and say, no, that doesn't work. We need to do it again, or we need to do it differently. With actors who, you know, might not have had any particular name before the Star Wars films came out, but were also like, you know, just doing this thing that didn't have any particular mythology associated with it. And as a result, could make jokes on set and build character with one another. The difference in texture between those movies and the movies where Lucas was the only main driver behind it, had complete authority over literally everything, and everything was handled in this sort of kind of top-down and authoritarian way where people were afraid of offending the big boss. That, like, the version with it came out of, I don't know, a pluralist kind of often antagonistic development process where people could say more what they felt and weren't beholden to this media juggernaut was the classic version, was the one that we all remember.
It's almost like the ragtag rebellion. Better than the big single.
Cool. Well, I think we have nitpicked or picked these nits or just cried about stuff we wish had happened as much as we can tonight. Do you have any final words, Django? Since, like I said, you started this brouhaha.
Somehow I did. Well, if you're interested in this stuff, I have two book series, one called Ashes of the Sun, which is more or less directly influenced by Star Wars, and the other one is a middle grade series called The Forbidden Library, which explores what happens when somebody tells you, hey, you're the chosen one, go kill these people that I don't like. And then, hey, you don't trust that person. So if you're interested in that, you could read them. But otherwise, just thank you, everyone, for like going along with this weird idea.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, some people don't invite me. I'm just, you know, here for the ride.
Cool. And everyone, love Star Wars for what it is. Dream about what it possibly could be. And, you know, support your local Star Wars authors.
Oh yeah, check out the Certain Point of View anthology.
Definitely.
And many, many other great authors.
Yes, I will definitely be promoting the Empire Strikes Back volume when it comes out. I think it's November, right?
I think so. I'd have to check, but yeah. That's not right.
But if you haven't checked out the A New Hope one that came out last year, do so now. Fix that. You need that in your life.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Okay. Thank you, everybody, for indulging in my brainstorm idea and Django's off-the-wall suggestion. I do want to apologize for the delay on this episode going out. Turns out my hosting company had a little bit of a catastrophe, so most of my websites were down over the weekend. Hoping this goes out sometime Sunday night. Not sure how much of the server performance and network connectivity will be recovered by then, but you will eventually see this. I'm hoping no later than Monday. That said, this is going to be relatively short because the show was so long. Yes, this is identical to the video that's on the YouTube channel for this session, but this is for the folks who prefer their podcast content via audio. Thank you all for listening, and I hope our Star Wars-ness didn't get too deep for you. And yes, I realized that at the beginning when I was comparing First Order, I said Republic instead of Empire. Yeah, I know already. Jeez. I'm also hoping to get the Batman Hush giveaway started. So if the website is up, it should be on the website. We're just going to have a regular standard giveaway. And it's a belated celebration of Batman Day, but things happen. Gremlins in the wires. You know how that works. Anyway, if you have any questions about Batman or Star Wars, please feel free to call in. The number is 602-635-6976, or you can shoot me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. And yeah, you can leave comments or questions in the comment section for this episode on the website. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi through Apple Podcast, through Google Play Podcast, through Stitcher, through TuneIn, through iHeartRadio Podcast, and Player FM. And if you're listening through Apple or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Let folks know you are enjoying the Geeky Deep Dives here, and maybe they should check them out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi, and we're also over on YouTube, youtube.com/sliceofscifi, and of course, the hub, the nexus, the foundation for all this geeky goodness, the website, sliceofscifi.com. I want to thank everyone who is helping support our efforts here at Slice of Sci-Fi and all of the other shows and websites in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe. Your pledges, your donations really do help keep the lights on around here. If you want to check out the perks of being a patron, the link is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Pick a perk level and you could be eligible for a prize, a book, a DVD, a Blu-ray, a 4K. Many of the items I get to review here, I don't keep forever and ever because I just don't have the space for it. So I give to you who have been so gracious in helping support my efforts here. I was recently informed that I have not updated the posts on the Patreon site since November of last year, and I really need to get better at that. I will try. I will do my very best. And also, if you would like to help support, but a monthly pledge commitment through Patreon is not a budget commitment you can make at this time, we have a PayPal link, paypal.me/sci-fi summer. And again, every bit that is donated, is pledged, all the support keeps the websites, the media online, and for that, I am eternally grateful. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening, And we will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.